The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the award-winning website creation platform that helps you make the front page. With Getty image integration and elegant templates, you can give your viewers the whole picture. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly. I'm Ollie Mann, and this week on the podcast, a phrase that's been bandied about a lot for the past few years but might finally be a reality. The Internet of Things.
Alexa, who is Ollie Mann?
Sorry, I didn't understand the question I heard.
Yeah, whatever.
Alexa, who is Ollie Mann?
The men include Bill Clinton, Sean Connery, Tony Blair, Guy Ritchie, A. C. Grayling,
Lamont Lanford,
and Carnegie. To see more, check out the Echo app.
To see more men.
My electronic sidekick there, Alexa, the approachable name for Amazon's sinister new smart device, the Echo. It makes ordering loo roll easier, but has it changed my life? And more importantly, who else is listening? Joining me to unpick the Internet of Things will be Gary Atkinson, Director of Emerging Technologies at IoT Chip Designers Arm, and Professor Philip Howard, who thinks the political potential of the IoT could outstrip its commercial potential. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It's tempting to still think of the Internet of Things as that Tomorrow's World vision from my childhood. Behold, the smart fridge. It'll let you know when the milk is off and order you another carton. But nowadays, the sector is growing fast. Faster than a weed that's being monitored for ultimate moisture levels through a compatible smartphone app. A recent report from Gartner says there will be almost 25 billion connected things by 2020. Everything from how we monitor our health to how we grow our crops. But do these things really make our daily lives any easier? I've spent the last week living with the Amazon Echo, which has just come out in the States and was smuggled to me in a suitcase from a friend in Silicon Valley, as it doesn't yet have a UK release date. It's basically a 360-degree speaker, looks like many other Bluetooth speakers, except it's controlled via a voice-activated personal assistant called Alexa, who is constantly connected to the web. She can answer your questions, she can play your music, and this, I suspect, is why Amazon invented her, if you've got a US Amazon Prime account, she can order you more products to be charged to your account and delivered to your door without you lifting a finger. She's always on, she's always connected, and so she's always constantly listening out for her name to receive your prompt or question. Here I am, giving her a run for her money.
Alexa, what is a podcast?
A podcast is a digital medium that consists of an episodic series of audio or digital radio, subscribed to and downloaded through web syndication or streamed online to a computer or mobile device.
I'd say that's fairly accurate. Some of the answers she gets, though, are a little US-centric. For example, Alexa, what is The Guardian?
The Guardian, the independent daily newspaper published in Lagos, Nigeria, by Guardian Newspapers Limited.
Yeah, I think Alan Rusbridger would be fuming about that if he was still around. I mean, what happened to the international profile, guys? Lagos. It's all about Lagos. Alexa, is Amazon evil?
No. Amazon.com is not an eagle.
No. Alexa, is Amazon evil?
I'm not sure what you meant by that question.
That's a surprise. Alexa, are you my friend?
Of course.
Well, joining me in the studio now are some real friends, our Guardian Tech panel this week, Samuel Gibbs, Nicole Kobe, and Julia Powles. Nicole, you've been testing out similar smart home devices like the Netatmo Welcome Camera and the Belkin Wemo plug. Are any of those, in your view, more credible than the Echo?
I wouldn't say so. You mentioned the Welcome Camera, and I've been living with that one for a couple of weeks now after reading the initial review. And pretty much all it's done is terrify me. So this is a facial recognition camera. So it learns your face. So when you walk in, it says, hey, Nicole's here. Or if it learns my boyfriend's face, it can say, oh, he's here. So that's great. I mean, I already know he's there because I let him in, but whatever. But it also sends notifications if something unexpected happens. So if there's movement when there isn't supposed to be. So last week I was coming home kind of late at night. It's dark out. Just as I'm walking up to the front steps, it sends me a notification saying there's movement detected in your flat, which is not really what you want to have to see. So I checked the little video clip and it was just a moth flying past the camera.
Well, there is movement there.
Yeah, it's true. There's movement. It's just not the kind that I really need to worry about. So it seems like a lot of these devices are kind of struggling a bit. And to be fair, that is probably the best device I've tried so far.
Okay. Was it getting more intelligent? Because I did find, in fairness to the Echo, that over time it got to know my voice a little bit better. It became more sensitive. It could understand what I was saying from further away. Presumably the camera is getting better at recognizing you.
Yeah, the camera spends a lot of time taking pictures of you, which is a little bit creepy. But if you're going to have a camera pointed at you, you're just going to have to kind of accept that. So every now and then it just pops up a little notification asking me to identify the people in the picture. And I live alone, so it's always me. And it's getting a lot better at telling, oh, well, sometimes she wears glasses, sometimes she doesn't. It gets really, really confused if I put my hair up or down. That's still getting it. So I figure the amount of time it's taken to get this far, and in maybe a few more weeks, I'll stop getting quite so many notifications.
It's interesting that you use the word creepy, because I have a feeling that's going to be a bit of a meme for this episode. It is the word that people often use when they spend any time with a device. And I did feel a little bit like that about the Echo myself. I started turning it off, even though the idea is it's always on, just because I thought, you know what, I don't want this particular conversation being monitored. Thank you very much. Samuel, we've got Apple's HomeKit and Google's Brillo coming around the corner, which is going to, they say, make all of this smart home stuff even more prevalent than it is now. It's going to stop being just a thing that tech journalists talk about and become a thing that everyone's using. Is that really going to happen, do you think?
Yes, I would say so, yes. We've finally got to the point where the hype level has hit capability, I suppose. So whereas we were talking about it in the future, now things can actually do things. And the key here has been the kind of the nexus point of sense capability and connectivity. So, I mean, the Internet of Things is essentially turning stupid things into a hive intelligence by connecting them to the Internet and to other devices. Now, I mean, you're right. Apple's got HomeKit, which it actually launched last year but didn't really do anything with, and now we finally might get a device out of it that might work. Google launched Brillo, a kind of like a cut-down version of Android that is designed to live on the restricted environments of internet-connected devices. And I mean, one of the things that really struck me was Samsung's pledge to make 100% of the devices it makes, which is a lot, from fridges, freezers to, you know, I mean, it even makes boats and things like that, 100% internet connected within 5 years. So I think we're actually at the point where many of the things that we think of as devices that could be Internet of Things have that capability built in now, but aren't actually connected up yet. And the biggest issue, I think, is what's going to be able to connect to what? I mean, is your Samsung fridge going to be able to talk to your Whirlpool dishwasher or whatever? You know, I mean, we're really kind of, we haven't worked that one out yet.
No, and it's not obvious that there's consumer demand for this either. I mean, obviously, when it comes to smart TVs, there is, because you can watch House of Cards on it. But, you know, when it comes to, do I need my hairbrush to be telling me it was yesterday at 12 o'clock that I last brushed my hair? I mean, even if it's the same price as a normal hairbrush, I think the answer to that is no.
I mean, I think when we look at the consumer applications of Internet of Things, I think we're limiting ourselves a bit. When the original concept of the Internet of Things was making everything work better for us, so that's smart cities, and smart cities have been banded around for ages. But if you think of the along the lines of, well, you know, your house knows when you're not in, so it turns off the heating so that you're not wasting electricity. That's a benefit to both you because it's reduced cost, but also to the national grid because it's less electricity usage, and the environment because you're burning less fossil fuels to produce this stuff. And the same thing, for instance, the bin, you know, the humble bin, right? Imagine it knows when it's full. And so instead of the council coming round and collecting your bins once a week or twice a week in my cases, it knows when it's full, and then it tots up how many houses have full bins and calculates the best time to come and collect them.
then you've got a Daily Mail scandal just waiting, haven't you? Yeah. The council are paying for this family who get their bin emptied five times a day. Julia, you're quite sceptical on where all of this is going, which we'll come on to more later. But in a nutshell, what is the legal situation around all of this data that's being harvested by all these devices? Even if it is convenient, even if you as a consumer like the idea, what are the repercussions here?
Well, yeah, it's interesting you emphasise the data point, because that is really at a consumer level what this is about. It's to some extent selling us back our stuff, but with data flows that we don't control. And I think the potential benefits or weaknesses of the Internet of Things are in control over data. That's kind of the key issue here. I mean, it's all very well, I'm all for efficient bins and washing machines, but I'm still unconvinced as to why they need to be routed through California in order to be efficient. And there's all sorts of potential. I mean, one of the dangers is we talk about the Internet of Things as a global concept, the web that we know it, you know, a global single interoperable network. But actually, IoT applications can be as decentralized as centralized. So I think control over data is kind of the key issue at a legal level. And legally, almost every country in the world, apart from the US, which is the outlier here, has quite strong data protection laws, which they've had for 20-odd years, which do put control at the individual level at the heart of the system. The problem we have is that with web and mobile, that opportunity and legal requirement hasn't really been satisfied, and we haven't had the control. And I think the success or failure of the IoT should depend on actually giving control to individuals. But the way that we see the tech development going is not in that direction. The tech development, because it's so complex and involves so many more moving parts than web and mobile, favours naturally dominant firms.
And yet the evidence seems to be with all these kinds of things, whether it's data protection or whether it's just our own feeling of slight discomfort, we get used to them fairly quick. And that's kind of what happened with Facebook, isn't it, Samuel? You know, people were like, oh, I don't want my stuff being pushed to other people's feeds unless they're interested in following me. And now we absolutely just accept that that's how Facebook works.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's going to be one of those cases where everybody's just going to go along with it until something really bad happens. I mean, I think there are two elements in this. The use of your data from a privacy point of view, basically somebody, for instance, Google's interest in this is because the more they know about you, the more targeted their ads can be. But there's also the capability, so when we're talking about the Internet of Things and the ability to have everything collected and, well, for instance, a camera, that's a gold mine to a hacker. If somebody decides they want to surveil you, it's very easy. I mean, we've looked at it from a point of view of stuff in the houses, but perhaps look at it from a point of view of a connected car, right? Today we've had the revelation that the Jeep Cherokee can be remotely hacked via the cellular data connection, right? And in theory, it is an Internet of Things device. The idea is the connectivity is designed to so you can start your car before you get in it to warm it up or something like that. But hackers have been able to take control of it, disable the brakes, disable the engine. I mean, they can control the steering. I mean, anything in there. And at that point, where do we draw the line? Security and privacy must be paramount.
Okay, well, the household, the car, these are only a few of the areas into which the Internet of Things is spreading its digital tentacles. Gary Atkinson is Director of Emerging Technologies at Arm, a company that designs the processors which provide a lot of the underlying architecture. Gary, for a layman, how does this technology work? How do all these machines talk to each other?
Well, it depends where they are within the network. So if we separate the network into three pieces. You've got all the devices at the edge of the network. So these would be sensors, actuators, the webcams we just talked about, your Echo device. They sit at the edge of the network. They mostly talk IP, which is what the internet protocol. It will go through some sort of gateway, and then it will talk at a high level the same language that the web pages talk, so HTTP. I mean, what we're seeing, particularly within and around the home, is the internet being cut down for low-power wireless connections, but the same protocols are being used.
And I suppose, I mean, this is partly the fault of journalists, isn't it? We'll focus inevitably because it's a novelty and because it's easy to understand. Here's a toothbrush that's got a chip in it. we'll focus on those novelty things. Here's a plant watering device. What else is there, apart from household objects? What are we going to see coming around the corner here that is actually web connected that isn't currently?
Well, I think there is potential, and I present at conferences about this, and I've been doing it for 18 months now. There is huge potential for society for Internet of Things connectivity. So if you look at four key areas like food, you know, we've got 2 billion people joining us by 2050. So how are we going to feed them? Where's the clean water coming from? How do we build a scalable healthcare system? How do we reduce energy consumption in a meaningful way, so we're not just scaling up more and more power stations? But in the meantime, by having lots of connected devices, so for example, sensors on farmland that allow you to only use the right amount of fertilizer and the right amount of water. We waste a significant amount of water in growing plants. India is the single biggest consumer of water. It uses twice as much as China. And this is predominantly because they water or irrigate from about 6 feet in the air, and most of it evaporates before it even hits the ground. Whereas if you use something called drip irrigation, then you significantly reduce your water consumption. So there are lots of examples where the connected device could really have a significant impact on society. It's not just a fridge that knows to order more milk.
There is also, I suppose, just to bring it right down to a domestic level again, the fear that your internet connection is going to go down. I mean, this is what I was thinking. You know, I wanted to have the choice to turn the Echo off. I also, if you agree with this, Nicole, felt a slight weird pang of anxiety when I realised it wasn't on. You're ceding control, in a sense, to broadband internet, which we have in this country, which isn't that great.
Well, you do. I mean, a lot of the devices I've been using are actually not off of my home internet. I mean, some of them are. The camera definitely is. But a lot of them are actually using my mobile phone connection. So a lot of this is going to be tied to our mobile phones, which is sort of where a lot of the privacy stuff comes in. So I had a Parrot Flower Power, which is, it just checks to see if your plant has enough water. It doesn't actually water it for you. It just checks that. But then it has to connect up to an app. And because it's on an app, it can tell who I am, and it can tell all sorts of different information that it's getting from my smartphone. So in a lot of ways, that a lot of this is actually going to end up going through your mobile network instead of through your home broadband, which raises a whole bunch of problems, especially when you come to just data usage. I mean, I've got a 1 gig a month cap. I haven't come anywhere near that yet, but once I've got my entire house on this, I don't know what that means, but it's probably going to be more expensive for me.
Yeah. Do you think, though, Gary, that we are going to be using increasingly the 4G or even possibly 5G signals on our mobile phones in the future? It's not going to be about broadband at all, and that will liberate this stuff even more then.
Well, I think we're actually in a particular transitional time right now. Everything that is appearing in the market, particularly for consumers, has to assume that there is no infrastructure in the home, that they cannot be reliant on consumers to deploy it. So the manufacturers of either the device or the service offering assume you have nothing, and they want it to work in isolation. Until we get that natural interoperability, you're going to have to go to the cloud in order to get one service to talk to another. This is just a transition. In the not too distant future, probably less than 5 years, those devices in your house will just talk to each other. And one way that we at Arm feel that we can accelerate that is by supporting an application level of interoperability. So Arm was part of the group that set up Thread. So Google's Nest, Arm, Samsung, trying to create a standard for high-level protocols to talk to each other, not just physically like Wi-Fi or Bluetooth level type of communication. And once you get those sorts of devices, it doesn't matter whether it's made by Whirlpool or Samsung or Google, those devices know how to talk to each other locally. And then you don't have to send all of this data to the cloud.
Good. And then one day, even my laundry machine will know who Ollie Mann is. Excellent. Thank you for that, Gary. Very well explained. Well, still to come, we'll look at some more of the ethical questions around this, because by God, we've just scratched the surface here. That's coming up next.
If you run a mobile business, you need an all-purpose API that lets your customers choose any way to pay. You need Braintree. Braintree work with Uber, Airbnb, GitHub and other leading companies to make their payment experiences seamless and magical. And now you can make the same thing happen on your app or website. With Braintree, you get a full stack payment solution plus live support that's with you from your first pound to your billionth. All you need is one snippet of code and you're ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. It doesn't matter if it's PayPal, Apple Pay, credit or debit cards. However your customers want to pay, Braintree has it covered, protected and made easy, globally and across any platform. To find out more and for your first £30,000 of transactions, fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com.
Well, we've seen the sort of product developments that are on the horizon for the Internet of Things, but what are the implications for our political systems of having an increasingly data-driven, hyper-connected world? Professor Philip Howard is the author of new book Pax Technica, How the Internet of Things May Set Us Free or Lock Us Up. And Philip, you're optimistic about the stabilizing potential of the Internet of Things on global politics.
Yeah, I think I'm mildly optimistic. I'd say that it's not too late to save the situation. The thing that's really driving the Internet of Things at this moment are, especially in the US and Canada, are the insurance companies and governments and data mining firms, Silicon Valley entrepreneurs that are basically looking for data. And I see the Internet of Things as basically being a loss leader for data. It's the data that's really valuable. And when politicians get access to good data, they use it. They use it to manipulate public opinion, and so that's the dangerous part that we could be facing shortly.
So what's the good side of that?
Well, the good side are the economic benefits that you all were talking about earlier. There's certainly a whole range of new business opportunities, right, that will come from having a chip embedded in everything that's human made. I think that it's not too late for civil society actors and even journalists to think about ways of using the Internet of Things to provide better services, to play with data, to solve collective action problems. That's why I say it's not too late. I'd say within the next 3-4 years, most of the Internet protocols will be set, standards will be set, and we'll have, you know, what we call in technology studies, we call lock-in. Basically, the Internet of Things will have arrived, and it'll be too late to change anything.
And Julia, you've been reading Philip's book and you've written a piece for The Guardian about it. Lots of questions I'm sure you'd like to ask him.
Well, I'm really interested. I know, Philip, you proposed several options for how we can reinsert civic counterpower into device networks. So perhaps you could cap on those. But then I'd also like to provoke whether there's some sort of deeper structural changes that we could make at this point, particularly around the sort of control and ownership of data points?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And I think you hit it on the head earlier when you said that the control issue is paramount. Most people won't be able to control the data that they generate. And for the first time ever, we'll have almost perfect behavioral data, right? For the most part, politics is fed by opinion data. Attitudinal data and data about our aspirations, the things we'd like our political lives to be about. But this will be perfect behavioral data on exactly which women are buying contraceptives, when, and who in the U.S. is buying guns and bullets, and all of this kinds of information that's extremely valuable politically will feed lobbyists, right? And so I want to find ways that civil society actors and we citizens can keep track of our data, maybe reclaim it. I'm probably one of the few academics who would admit who would argue that we've probably lost the privacy war for this internet, but it's not too late to recapture our privacy, perhaps by directing our data. If we could choose to add additional organizations to the list of groups that get access to our data, I see that as a civic opportunity in the years ahead.
Yeah, so I think there are the potential for those sort of collective action problem solving that you mentioned. But do you really, with the sort of consumer product level, is there something that we're really able to gain, even with the more people that have access to this data? You know, you mentioned at the end of the book that perhaps there isn't yet a collective action problem that can be solved by our connected coffee machines or our connected washing machines. I mean, if this is just our imagination, then isn't it taking us down a pathway that really is the end of privacy and autonomy?
Yeah, I think it will be very difficult to, at least with this, with mobile phones and the internet we experience over our browsers, we can opt out, right? We have some control over the cookies in our browsers. We can choose to turn our equipment off. In a world of 20, 30 billion devices collecting bits of data, it will be very difficult for us to opt out. We won't be able to opt out of our neighbors' information infrastructure, right? And so there'll be serious legal privacy questions there. I think the best opportunity for us is to imagine ways of directing our data flows purposefully. So one of the ideas I propose in the book is basically I took from the Blood Diamonds campaign from a few years ago. I think it would be very important for us to be able to look at our device, our toothbrush, our wireless toothbrush, and have it list for us the organizations that are benefiting from the data collected by the toothbrush. Just being able to give us as a consumer all the third parties, all the advertisers, all the lobbyists who might be interested in that toothbrush data, just being able to produce that list would be an important step to understanding how many different groups want and use and manipulate our data. The next step for me would be able to add groups to the list. So if we have a favorite toothbrush charity, you know, this is a silly example, but if we have a favorite toothbrush charity, I should be able to send them my data if I want to.
I'm gonna say some words that some people are probably thinking. Orwell, surveillance, Snowden. I mean, knowing what we know about how governments not just like to see our data, but given the opportunity to hack into a device that's literally listening to every conversation we're having, knowing that governments are likely to want to be able to use that if given the opportunity, maybe it's naive to talk about any notion of opting out.
I agree with that. I'm not sure it'll be easy. I don't think it'll be possible to opt out of the Internet of Things. I think you could move far, far north or far, far south to get out of it. But, you know, if 5 years from now, 10 billion people and 3 or 4 times as many wireless devices, all with a sensor, a tiny power pack, and an address on the Internet, it will generate an immense amount of data. And I should point out, actually, that all of us so far have been talking about consumer electronics and the use of the Internet of Things for sort of monitoring nature. The Internet of Things will also be very much about our bodies. It will be about medical innovations that come with wireless chips that get embedded in us, that help us with our health. So these will also be very personal technologies. And I agree, I'm not sure we'll be able to opt out of this world.
Gary, is that something that you've been working on as well, chips that can be implanted theoretically into human beings?
Well, actually, there are a good couple of examples. So one is that in order for medication to be really to work well, it has to be taken at certain times of the day, maybe after meals or with some sort of liquid. And particularly the elderly, they don't necessarily like to be told what to do sometimes, and so they avoid taking their medication even though they know it should be good for them. But you can actually put a tiny little radio transmitter on a pill, consumable, and it has an anode and cathode, but it has no electrolyte. And actually the acid in your stomach creates the battery acid, so to speak. It creates enough power for it to generate a signal to a locally worn device that says this medication was taken. So for those life-threatening diseases that require medication at certain times of the day or a certain frequency, that, you know, that could be life-saving. The data generated there, again, you know, to Philip's point, could be aggregated together for good. So you could take all of that data, send it to research institutions to work out how medications react to different body types and et cetera. But it could also be used for nefarious reasons as well.
Yeah, and however you spin it, I mean, that sounds like an amazing piece of technology if you had someone with dementia, for example, and you were worried and anxious for them that they took their medication. But then they're also losing some civil liberties to choose not to take that pill, aren't they? You could imagine prisoners, for example, instead of wearing tags, having chips implanted into their skulls. So every single one of these innovations comes with quite a scary underbelly, and it seems like people aren't petitioning to make sure that those political safeguards are in place at this stage. They're kind of experimenting, seeing what happens.
Absolutely, and it's got so many interesting potential applications, some really challenging technical problems. So you see the thirst and enthusiasm from tech developers, from governments who see new economic opportunities. But I think that so many of these innovations could actually be managed at a local level, could actually involve you, for example, with your relative who has dementia. But I'm not really satisfied with just having a list of who else has it. I think that we shouldn't even be getting to that point, because it's all very well having the list, but if there's no opt-out, you know, it's just terrifying, really. So I think it comes back to those points about control and power. And in fact, the legal infrastructure is largely in place to ensure that. And I think there's a real responsibility on those developing this technology to think about it, not just having it interoperable, not just connecting everything, but why are we doing it? And as more hacks come, as we see, that's right, the example of the Jeep. I mean, what happens if somebody takes over all the washing machines in London and starts flooding our houses? I mean, we should be inserting, before the crisis comes, I think, some of these more robust counterpower mechanisms.
I mean, Gary, do you acknowledge there is a lack of people asking why? However great the technology is, however great the innovation is.
I think for some people, creating something new out of new technology is the challenge in itself, and the implications of what they've created isn't really their driving concern. I think once it starts to be deployed and starts to gain critical mass, then, you know, as an industry, we need to be looking at that and saying, you know, are we doing this for the right reasons?
So I'm interested in two aspects that we haven't really been able to get into too much. One is the implications at a social level in terms of these data flows and the differential impacts it might have on society. One of the issues with surveillance, I think, is that it has disproportionate impacts on certain demographic groups that are more closely monitored and therefore more inhibited in their actions. And the second is about the environmental and energy cost of actually the infrastructure deployment and connectivity, and whether we're accounting for that correctly when we say we'll have these great gains at an energy environmental level. What about the actual cost of connecting?
I have never seen a sort of an energy audit of what the estimated impact of IoT and its energy costs would be. I would bet that for the most part, the Internet of Things will make our energy use more efficient. Many of the companies that are actually rolling their IoT technologies out are building for these smart cities, and they're trying to meet a demand from government for better sensors on traffic lights and water supplies and electricity energy supplies. And so I bet that it'll make our economies more efficient in a sort of a big picture way. I think that the disproportionate impact problem is one that we really need to address, because as the Internet of Things rolls out, it'll probably be the rich cities and the wealthier countries that generate most of the data, that get the technologies first. So I think it's very likely that the Internet of Things will promulgate some of that economic inequality, economic disparity that we've seen promulgated by the existing Internet.
Julia, I know that one thing you've proposed as a possible alternative is the Internet of People. Summarize what that means for us.
Well, I think we sort of have these two destinies. We have the big data prophets who are saying that this is going to create this efficiency. We'll be able to have much more fine-grained management. And I'm concerned about some of those inequality distributions and the seemingly inevitable cost of surveillance. And then you have the people who think this just sounds terrible and like we completely lose control. So I think the Internet of People idea would be that we very much put the individuals at the heart of whatever we're doing. We don't connect things just because, you know, Samsung has a pledge to connect everything. We ask first why, and we are assured that we get something more out of this than the manufacturer does, and that we are thinking about how technology affects our lives in ways that actually means that we have as much the benefit of disconnectivity as we do of connectivity. There was a lovely piece we had this week on the search for solitude and the fact that if we imagine the sort of ultimate version of a sort of well-maintained, butlered Victorian house, for the modern age, it would be as much giving us some distance from technology, ensuring that instead of the flood of email and social media that distracts us, that we have more sensitive, human-centric experiences that say you need to pay attention to this now, but actually give us as much space to sort of take away the menial and to focus on what's important.
Okay, and just to end by returning to where we began, Nicole, you were living with this stuff in your house for a couple of weeks. Has what you've heard over the last 35 minutes or so changed your opinion about any of it? Are you more enthusiastic or are you more terrified?
Kind of a mixture. I mean,
I'm not particularly enthusiastic about most of the devices that I have because they just don't work very well. But the thought of having a device that sort of, you know, surveils your home for genuine security reasons, but doesn't do a very good job of it, but might in the long term lead to all of these negative, you know, knock-on effects. Well, I'm not getting much out of it. And if the company's getting all of this out of it, I don't see why I'd pay, you know, £200 to have this thing in my house. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm kind of intellectually fascinated by it, but I'm not sure I'm any less terrified. I'm guessing, Samuel, despite your concerns about the Jeep, actually, you are quite excited to try all this new shiny stuff out.
I see great benefits in it, but it's one of those things where I think it's the point at which we don't notice it and it's become genuinely useful. So if you notice it, what's the point? Like, for instance, I now have a smart thermostat. It's the summer. I don't need it. It's off. When it comes to the winter, it will heat the house up when it's required, but only when it's required, and I hope to never have to look at it.
Well, I'm glad that we noticed this technology for the sake of doing this episode. Gary Atkinson, thank you very much for joining us. Philip Howard as well. And also to my panel, Nicole Kobe, Julia Powles, and Samuel Gibbs. And Alexa as well, who's gone back in her box. I've been Ollie Mann. Follow me on Twitter and Facebook. Ollie with a Y, M-A-N-N. The producer is Alana Chance. And we'll see you next week.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.